Welcome back to an all-new episode of Dirtcast. I am your host, Madeline Davies, back after a little blip in the scheduling system.
And I am your other host, Megan Reynolds, who is here by the skin of her teeth due to another blip in my personal system.
You know what? Blips happen.
Blips happen.
But I think you're going to forgive us because our guest today is, I'm going to say legendary.
I would say so.
I'm so excited. You know her as Alexis Nyers of Pretty Wild and formerly The Bling Ring.
Yes.
Her name is Alexis Haynes. She is now a sobriety counselor and doula, and she is here to talk to us about getting sober in the entertainment industry and in Hollywood. And it's a topic that she knows quite personally.
Yes.
You know, for my personal experience, like, fame, it brings the fire to the gasoline, right? It makes everything explode because you now have access to... It's like you're a kid in the candy store. Like, you have access to every drug, any nightclub that you want. It's very, very challenging.
In lieu of doing kind of our usual breakdown, we're actually going to kind of talk all this episode about sobriety and drug addiction. But particularly, we're going to be talking kind of about the opioid crisis and how it pertains to celebrity in relation to Demi Lovato's recent apparent overdose. I don't think they've confirmed anything.
I don't think so either.
But it's been all but confirmed. And she is in the hospital.
Right. She hasn't been released yet.
No, surrounded by loved ones. There's been this big outpouring of support from other celebrities. She apparently will be going straight to rehab after she's released. And she's been really public about her struggles.
The sort of very compressed version on Tuesday of last week, she was found unconscious in her home in the Hollywood Hills. Her overdose was first reported by TMZ as a heroin overdose.
Naturally, TMZ.
Thanks, TMZ. You are the best. They had to walk that back because it was not necessarily a heroin overdose. I don't think there's anything that confirms exactly what she overdosed on.
No, again, it's not even confirmed that she overdosed.
Right. So it's just something, there is an incident categorized at first as a heroin overdose, backed up to say it was not a heroin overdose. We still don't know what specifically happened. As Maddie said, she will be, when she is released from the hospital, which as of this recording has not happened yet, she will be heading straight to rehab.
I mean, like a lot of people in her situation, I mean, and I mean as an addict, this is a really long-running struggle for her, where her birth father was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and she, according, this is what she said herself in her YouTube documentary, Simply Complicated, that she always searched for what he found in drugs and alcohol. And then she adds, I wasn't working my program. I wasn't ready to get sober. I was sneaking cocaine on planes. I was sneaking it in bathrooms, sneaking it throughout the night.
Nobody knew.
This is an 18-year-old who's totally outmaneuvering adults.
I went on like a bender of like 2 months where I was using daily, and
she said that at her worst she was either craving drugs or on drugs.
I was not easy to work with. I was using while I had a sober companion, and I went through about 20 different sober companions.
It was really like she was two different people. Every day was like going to war.
We were in Palm Springs, and she locked her bedroom door. She's just taken a bunch of pills. We kick down the door. She gets taken to the hospital. The nurse is checking her in. The bottle of pills is there. She grabs the pills. She then downs all the other pills and says, you bitch, if I just tried to kill myself, why would you give me access to pills?
I didn't feel anything. I didn't feel guilty. I didn't feel embarrassed.
She first tried cocaine while working at the Disney Channel at age 17. In 2010, she left a tour early to enter treatment. She's been diagnosed with bipolar disorder since then.
In 2011, which is when she finished her first round of treatment, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and she's kind of been in and out of treatment because, like we've been saying, this is lifelong.
Yeah.
And she recently released a song called Sober, which implied that she had relapsed.
Mama, I'm so sorry I'm not sober anymore. Daddy, please forgive me for the drink spilled on the floor. To the ones who never left me, we've been down this road before. I'm so sorry, I'm not sober.
she broke down in tears last month while singing this song at a concert. But she's by far not the first person who has publicly dealt with this.
Certainly not. I mean, we've got a whole list here that goes back. I mean, Tom Petty and Prince both died from accidental fentanyl overdoses.
And that's in the past 2 years.
Yep. Heath Ledger died almost 10 years ago, over 10 years ago?
10 years ago.
The official cause of death was acute intoxication due to a combination of prescription drugs, which included oxycodone, hydrocodone, diazepam, and alprazolam. Michael Jackson also overdosed. Whitney Houston, Glee star Corey Monteith, Philip Seymour Hoffman. And these are only in since like the 2000s.
Yeah, these are just of the past 10 years.
Yeah.
So this is from a piece by John Temple that was posted to HuffPo called 10 Years After Heath Ledger's Death, The Opioid Epidemic Rages On. Awareness of prescription drug abuse is rising, but so are overdoses, which killed about 64,000 Americans in 2016, up from 34,450 in 2008.
So it is, as evidenced by that, it's only getting worse.
And it's obviously a national problem.
Yeah.
It's like this is Oxy and these things are just like easy to get for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Doctors overprescribe it.
Yeah.
But now it's kind of swung back around where doctors aren't prescribing it. So the people who actually kind of need these drugs are having a harder time. But it's like the damage is really done where it's like especially in rural areas, mm-hmm. I think, like there's parts of Massachusetts mm-hmm. and, you know, the Northeast coast that have been devastated. I have multiple high school friends who have died from heroin overdoses.
Yeah.
There's definitely been like a fascination in pop culture with drug abuse. And like you see it in like, you know, how many people do you know in college whose favorite movie was Requiem for a Dream?
Oh, God.
And I don't
or like Trainspotting.
Yeah, I had a Trainspotting poster in my room. I was really into it.
Right.
I think in the past 10 years, sort of on cable in mm-hmm. particular, there's kind of been an uprising of shows focusing on intervention and sobriety.
Yeah.
But they're not, it's hard to tell if they're good or bad, right? Like intervention, I don't know what the success rate of intervention is.
I have no idea. I can't imagine it's very high.
Like, what I've been trying to think of is, like, take Celebrity Rehab, for example, mm-hmm. with Dr. Drew. A lot of people who've been on that show have died.
Yeah.
Since being on it. I don't know if we can blame that show, though, because I also just wonder what the success rate of rehab in general is.
Like, Intervention, the show on A&E.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I wonder how good that is. Like, on the one hand, it's, like, showing, like, yes, this is, you know, the lowest of the low. This is like the bottom of the barrel. But I don't necessarily know if interventions and getting an addict to actually get to rehab is something that necessarily needs to be televised.
One thing we talk about with Alexis later in the episode is how shame motivates addiction.
Yes.
And I feel like, as you were kind of alluding to, putting someone's, like, most painful moment.
Like, lowest moment.
On TV. Like, I feel like that could spur, if anything, like, a bender.
Oh, totally. I guess the implication is that you would think that it would spur not a bender, but, like, oh, fuck, like, okay.
Yeah.
I really need to, like, button it up. I don't think it necessarily works that way.
So one thing I'm going to say that I feel like might get some pushback with regards to Celebrity Rehab with Dr. Drew
mm-hmm.
is that I do think that that shows the reality of treatment in a way that other shows or movies do not.
Mm-hmm. I've never seen it, to be honest.
So it's basically just people of note who need treatment.
Mm.
Checking into this rehab center
that's
run by Dr. Drew and,
gotcha.
Like, some sober counselors who, to their credit, seem very on top of their shit.
That's good.
Again, it's like, what does having cameras do for the people?
Right.
But I think as like a viewer, this is not like Girl Interrupted. This is like there's nothing cute about it or complicated about it. It's just like these people whose lives have been fucking ravaged and their careers ruined.
By their addiction.
By addiction. Mm-hmm. And like there's one scene that I think of a lot actually because it's so upsetting in that it was Mackenzie Phillips who was there for her treatment. This is around the time that she came out saying that she had been raped by her father for many years.
Okay.
She actually, like, tells Dr. Drew on the show, but it's behind closed doors and not in—
Not, like, on not, camera?
Yeah, okay. Or on mic. She is roommates with the country singer Mindy McCready, who has actually—she's since died. And they're just joking around, and suddenly Mindy McCready falls off the bed and starts seizing. And—
Jesus Christ.
Mackenzie Phillips laughs because she thinks that she's joking.
Oh, my God.
And you just see the moment of her realizing that this isn't a joke, where she's like, ah, stop fucking around. And then she, like, suddenly is like, oh, my God, and, like, gets help.
Oof.
But, I mean, I could once see being in Mackenzie Phillips' position where it's like you think your friend's fucking around and they're not. But it was just horrifying.
That's wild.
Yeah, and it's just, like, these people, are, again, like, they're just, like, their skin is, like, totally depleted.
Right.
Just everything. And it's so sad. Like, their relationships have been ruined with so many people. I don't really know why they choose to do it on camera. I don't know if it's, like, their own narcissism or if there's maybe something, like, where they don't have to pay I bet they don't have to pay
That's
for treatment.
That's what I was thinking, yeah. Maybe it's, like, a free treatment in exchange for this.
Which itself is, feels like really unethical.
That's not a good, that doesn't sit right with me personally. I have zero ethics, but I can tell you right now, that sounds pretty bad.
But I don't know. Again, it's like, what does work? I feel like that's kind of the problem we're in right now is that our current models don't work. They are not equipped to handle.
Either like the scale that we need or just the methodology isn't necessarily working.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing to talk about is, like, how being a celebrity enables you to get whatever you want.
Yes.
You
that
know,
is.
From the age that, like, from a very young age.
Right. The it sounds bad saying, like, the classic example, but Drew Barrymore very publicly struggled with addiction, started drinking at 9, smoking pot at 10 or 11, started doing cocaine at 13. And by 15 or so, she was clean.
I mean, and her mom was, like, taking her to Studio 54.
Yeah.
You know? There's that, like, very famous picture of her, like, lighting the guy's cigarette when she was, like, 6.
Yeah. It was, I mean, yes. Like, as a famous person, people are already predisposed to, like, give you things that you want.
Yeah. It's like a Venn diagram of two different types of selfishness where, like, I think as an addict, like— your world is all about getting drugs. So you kind of already are, like, very egocentric.
Primed, right,
you are thinking about yourself all the time just because your addiction is making you think about yourself all the time.
Right.
And then as a celebrity, you are thinking about yourself all the time because you are a celebrity and you're getting hired because you're you.
Yeah.
And people are giving you what you want all the
time because
you're you.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's sort of like this Venn diagram that can list very easily become a circle of, like— nightmare.
A nightmare circle, yes.
But yeah, I just, like, I feel like if you're someone who has the disposition of addiction, I just think it's, like, a world that really, if you have that in you, really increases the chances—
of it becoming a problem.
Of it becoming a problem and of your inability to control yourself. For anybody who reads the news, you are probably aware that the opioid epidemic has just spiked over the past 10 years, and that's very notable in Hollywood because that is sort of where so much of our attention is focused. So joining us today is someone who, in both her career and her life, has a lot of experience with addiction, Alexis Haynes. Hi, Alexis.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
We really appreciate you being here. So for better or for worse, you know, what you're most known for in the public eye is Pretty Wild and then The Bling Ring. But you have since then discussed about how there's more than what meets the eye in both of those situations, in that you were at that point in your life already using drugs and alcohol as a coping mechanism. So I'm kind of wondering, could you just sort of talk us through your addiction and then your path to sobriety a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. I began using drugs when I was really young. I was probably about 12 the first time that I had tried alcohol. And in middle school, I, you know, was smoking cigarettes and starting to explore. I was prescribed prescription drugs like Adderall around that time in my life as well. And what ended up happening for me was I had a couple of surgeries and I was prescribed pain pills. And the first time that I had a pain pill, it did something for me like no other drug ever had. And I had this kind of profound experience where I felt really warm and fuzzy and really safe. And for a kid that grew up in an environment that was loaded with multiple forms of trauma, I had an alcoholic father and a mom who also used substances for pretty much my entire life. They divorced when I was really early. My dad was physically abusive and violent towards me. And I was sexually abused via incest from a really young age, starting around 4 years old. And that sexual abuse and rape continued for several years. And then I also had another sexual assault when I was 16. But that was after I'd already begun using drugs. So I had all of this trauma that was undealt with. And the first time that I tried opiates, it was like most, you know, heroin addicts say it's like a warm hug. And that's really what it was like for me. And so I began taking Vicodin, and eventually I found a supplier for OxyContin. And I was hooked right away. My addiction started when I was about 16 years old to Oxy. And eventually I became a full-blown IV heroin addict. And that was right before I got arrested for the second time, which was a drug charge in 2010. And I've been sober ever since.
Yeah, if you have that kind of traumatic of an environment from such a young age, how could you not try to escape that kind of in any way that you can find for yourself?
I mean, it wasn't intentional. The brain is really interesting in the way that it protects us from trauma. So sometimes people shut down, which is what happened to me and a good chunk of my trauma, where you remember the environment, you remember smells and you remember sounds and things like that, but you don't actually remember the events until you start working through it in therapy. And so the brain has certain ways that it protects itself. And so when a person who's been through abuse, like I had been through, we know that especially for children, your brain develops differently than normal kids who don't have adverse childhood experiences. And so I was basically doomed the first time that I tried a drug. Like, that was game over for me. I didn't know that that would be the case, but that's pretty much the way that it works, is the drug provides stimulation to certain parts of the brain that need stimulation, that haven't had stimulation in the past because it's been shut down from trauma. And so I didn't know what I was getting myself into. I didn't know how, the drugs were really working for me and why I became addicted until after I got sober and I ended up going to school to become a licensed drug and alcohol counselor. And that's when I started really learning about the way that these things affect people.
So basically, some people just are predisposed to addiction. And if they are kind of given that door to walk through, that door is now open. Would you say that's about accurate?
Well, yeah, there's no genetic component. Like, there's no addiction gene. There's this thing called epigenetics, you know, and it's all really interesting stuff. But basically, yes, if you have a certain set of genes, like, some people are more sensitive than others, right? That's just in your genetic makeup. That's just the way that it is. And so if you're a more sensitive person, if you're more predisposed to being less resilient than some people, and then your body and your brain goes through trauma, when you then introduce a substance, yes, it feeds that need. And so people become addicted.
You work as a counselor at Allo House, right?
Well, I've had children for, I have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. So I'm no longer working as a counselor. Like, I'm not there 9 to 5. However, I have certain special cases where Evan, my husband, who is the owner of Allo, will call me and say, you know, we've got this client. I think that she would really benefit from doing a couple sit-downs for you. Would you come in and speak with her? Then I will. You know, we have this one client and I feel like you'd be best to do the assessment. Can you come in? I say yes. And then for the last couple of years, we've really been trying to give addicts a voice and to talk about addiction in the media more. It kind of gets like glossed over. Mm-hmm. Occasionally you'll hear a random statistic like, you know, in 2016 and ever since. But in 2016, we found out that addiction is now the leading cause of death for people under 50. So you would see that on the news and people would talk about addiction, but you never hear from actual drug addicts themselves. And so this year alone, we've made like several appearances on like the TV show, The Doctors. And so Evan and the business will call me to go on and talk about addiction and talk about my story and talk about, you know, why it's important to get sober and helping people and things like that. So I do a number of things. I also work as a doula.
Wow. That's very intense.
Yeah. And I teach childbirth education too. And that's kind of, my heart is between both places. And I think both things really are kind of intertwined with each other because I believe that trauma is the leading cause of addiction. And I believe that trauma is preventable by having strong family systems. And that begins with pregnancy. That begins with the mother. And so when the mother has a traumatic birth experience, which many women in the United States do, we have the highest maternal death rate of any westernized country, and more than 1 in 3 women give birth by major surgery via C-section in this country, which is a major health crisis that no one else is talking about. when women, you know, aren't heard, and when they're not allowed to make their own medical choices on, you know, regards to how they give birth in this country, and they have traumatic birth that leads to more cases of postpartum depression and anxiety, and, you know, and it all just trickles down. So I believe that it's all kind of intertwined, and it's all important work that I'm very passionate about.
So I guess one question I have, which I think that you probably have a lot of expertise or at least thoughts in, is how addiction in Los Angeles and Hollywood, or as someone who is in the public eye, how that changes things.
Yeah, I think that that definitely makes things a little bit more tricky. You know, for my personal experience, like, fame, it brings the fire to the gasoline, right? It makes everything explode because you now have access to, it's like you're a kid in the candy store. Like, you have access to every drug, any nightclub that you want. It's very, very challenging when you're suffering and when you have this internal pain that you're suppressing with drugs, it almost puts like a flashlight on it. Like, sure. It's really hard to hide it. And like, I'm a perfect example of that. Like, I was caught multiple times by TMZ and other online publications walking out of clubs, like completely
fucked up, basically.
So high, so drunk, like just not able to form a sentence, which actually just makes your addiction worse, right? Because shame is crippling.
Right. It's so embarrassing that how can you forget it, you know?
Shame is crippling. And I think that as a society, we really like to point fingers and we really like to look at other people's problems. And so then you have the comment section, you know, which makes like everything 1,000 times worse because like you already feel shame, which I love Brené Brown. She's an amazing author. And she recently came out with a book called I Thought It Was Just Me, But It Isn't. And it talks about shame and it talks about the difference between guilt and shame. Shame is I am a bad person. Shame is I am a piece of crap. Shame is, oh, I'm just an addict and I'll never change. Guilt is I am a good person. Why am I doing this to myself? And so right. When we feel shame, it's literally crippling. And then you have the heat of the public and all of their commentary, you know, and you're, as addicts, we're naturally sensitive people. So you feel all of this pressure. And none of this is motivating. And none of this is really helping anyone get anywhere near, like, really having a good shot at sobriety. I mean, my sister, Tess, and I used together for basically since the beginning of my addiction to the end. And she continued to use after. And I became really close with Bob Forrest, who is a co-founder of Allo, my husband's treatment center. And
the frontman of Thelonious Monster.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so you know Bob. Okay, Bob is great.
Yes.
And he's kind of this punk rock dude, and he has this really like unconventional theories about addiction and addicts and life, and he's one of my mentors, and I just adore him. But I was trying to get my sister sober for probably like the third or fourth time, and I wanted to stage this whole intervention, and I wanted it to be really public, and I wanted to like show up where I knew she would be and basically like kidnap her and bring all of her family and friends around and basically like tell her how horrible it is that she's using and how much she's hurting us and like all of this stuff. And my intention was to help, but I wasn't being helpful because that was just going to shame her. You know, and I didn't really think about the fact that she's using because she's still in so much pain. And we really had this amazing experience together where I was able to be heartfelt and non-judgmental, loving and kind and understanding and to really listen to her. And I think that that's what worked. I mean, 2 weeks later, she got sober and now she's got 5 years. And so when you think about celebrity and when you think about the way that we scrutinize celebrity addicts when they're out there using, and we all have an opinion. And then when they die, we feel terrible and we mourn them. Like it's like it's the saddest thing in the whole world. And how could they do that? How could they take their life? How could they overdose?
This wasted potential.
The toxic ways that we as a society view addicts and view addiction, it's a lot of scapegoating. It's really unfortunate because the truth of the matter, and this is really what I believe, is there's 23.5 million Americans addicted to drugs. But everybody is addicted to something. And we're either addicted to working out, sex, drugs, alcohol, cell phones, video games, whatever it is, gambling. Everybody's addicted to something and nobody wants to talk about why.
Like, it's like we have these coping mechanisms, but we're not talking about what we're coping with.
What we're coping for. But shame on all the drug addicts, and drugs should be illegal, and we should lock them all up. And, you know, so we have this really harsh view on addicts, and we scapegoat them, and we look at them as the problem children, you know.
Mm-hmm.
For you in particular, I think a unique challenge must have been that because you were on reality TV, is that there is sort of this like Schadenfreude element of how people are looking at you. You know, it's like you have someone like Demi Lovato who people are rooting for. You know, it's like she's like the right kind of person. And then I feel like if you are on reality TV or have been arrested before or that type of thing, it's sort of, there's like pleasure in your suffering.
That's very true. And I think as a society, we do it to celebrities and we do it to even like poor people. We're like, well, it's their fault they're poor. I mean, and like we blame, right. We so quickly blame people that don't fit into our ideals and our own moral compass about like what is good and what is bad. But it's not, certainly, it's not a matter of what, who is good and who is bad. It's just like varying degrees of suffering and circumstance.
Right. If you're existing in that dichotomy of good and bad, it's already off, you know, because it doesn't really exist in that way.
Like, I remember I said something, and I do regret it, but I remember someone was like, well, I mean, you do drugs, and you rob houses, and you do this, and you do that, and I was like, yeah, and wasn't Khloe Kardashian just a few years ago, like, arrested for a DUI? Like, she could have killed somebody, like, driving right. drunk, but I'm, like, the worst, you know? Like, and right. I regret saying it. But I think about it now, I regret saying it because it was like, it's like comparing two bad things, right? Like, and we shouldn't compare, but it really speaks to the way that society like measures like what is appropriate and what isn't.
And what is a person's worth.
Yeah, and what is a person's worth and value, you know what I mean? So I agree, and I think that I was really young, and I put myself out there to be a spectacle, and man, was I ever.
Right.
I really let it all out.
Yeah, your rebellious period was a little bit more hardcore than
guns
most
a-blazing.
People's. But look at you. I don't know. I think, like, the fact that you have turned all of these things into such, not a positive experience, but a learning experience and something to evolve from and help other people with is really admirable.
Yeah, you know, I get asked all the time, like, if you could go back in history and redo it all, like, would you? And my answer is always no. No, because I don't think that I would have the insight, the compassion, the empathy, the awareness, and the authenticity that I have today. And I don't like the word shameless, but like I don't live in shame anymore. And I think I think almost everybody walks around living in shame. And I honestly don't. Like I really don't. I feel really secure in the person that I am today. And I feel like because of that, I'm able to be helpful and I'm able to help people. And I think that that's a huge gift. And, you know, when you see it as a gift that you're able to give back to other people, then I think, you know, no, I would not. All those days in jail, all of the pain, all of the trauma, all of the shame and ridicule and all of that, I wouldn't go back. Because the connections that I have with people today, you know, and the letters that I get from people in my email and on Instagram and such of, wow, you really helped me and you inspired me to get sober and all of that, there's nothing better.
So speaking of the work that you're doing now and the work that your husband is doing, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about why the addiction treatment industry kind of has evolved into something so destructive.
Well, selfishness and greed, just like any other, you know, look at the pharmaceutical industry, all these scientists wanting to help people and now they're killing people with their opiates.
Right.
And, you know, now we have Suboxone, which I think is a great tool to detox, although I never used it to detox. I always just kicked cold turkey. But they're putting 18 and 19 year olds on lifelong, you know, Suboxone prescriptions. And it's,
wow.
If you consider that sobriety, like, you are sorely mistaken, because that
right.
it's not the fact that you're still high, which you very much so are. It's that you cannot do the work that it requires to maintain long-term sobriety and to become a productive member of society again and to move past your trauma when you're still on that much Suboxone, which is just a synthetic opiate. That's all that it is. So all of these things start out as, you know, we want to help people, and then it turns into greed. And I think that that's definitely one of the big issues. I think that everybody just saw this opportunity as a get rich quick kind of thing. And so you had all these investors dropping millions of dollars into creating these huge places. And then when they're not getting the return that they need, they do things like, you know, that are really sketchy. You know, I won't get into all the details about all the sketchy things that they're doing, but really sketchy stuff. And then I also think that there is a model shift that needed to take place. Whole compassionate care model where we don't believe in control. And so you had all of these really heavy 12-step-based treatment centers, which I also don't agree with, because you shouldn't be paying for 12-step. 12-step is a free program. It was always meant to be a free program. I don't think you should be profiting off of that. So you had all of these 12-step-based programs with a punitive approach, you know, where like, you don't know anything and, you know, like just talking down to people and you need to follow direction and all of that. I think that that works really well for maybe the 40 or 50 year old alcoholics, you know, that are just like lifelong alcoholic males or even females. But for the 19-year-old heroin addict, and I mean, like the majority of the of our patients that we see are 19 to 33 years old. And that is literally the population of drug addicts right now. I mean, like, they're young. They're young. It's rare that you see a 55-year-old heroin addict walk into our doors.
I imagine that you probably get sober or you die, you know, by that point.
Yeah, especially now with, like, heroin's not what it used to be in the 80s. You know, like, when Bob was using dope, like, you didn't have drug dealers that were trying to kill you with, like, fentanyl-laced heroin. I mean, like, they wanted to keep you around so you would keep buying heroin. Like, you know, but now you see all of this, like, crazy, like, laced stuff that's, like, just people are just dropping like flies, which is crazy. Yeah. But I don't think, you know, like when you have these this generation of kids that grew up with the friend parent, which is like the worst thing that you can do for your kids, where you're just their friend and, you know, you don't care if they're smoking pot and whatever else, aka my mother, and they have zero life skills, these kids. They don't know how to put together a resume. They don't know how to open a bank account. They don't know how to build credit. I mean, they are freaking helpless. Their parents have done them a disservice by picking up the pieces for them in their lives all the time and not teaching them basic life skills. They don't know how to do the freaking dishes. I'm not kidding you. And so you have this population of young people who are helpless, who are ashamed because they are so helpless. They know they can't do anything. They have these egos that tell them they're the best thing in the world because their parents gave them trophies even if they lost their whole lives. But at the same time, they believe that they're pieces of crap, you know? So you have this kind of like this dual like argument going on between the two of them. And and then you're going to try to put them in like a 12-step based program.
Like suddenly teach them discipline.
And like suddenly teach them discipline, like not going to happen. And you have to remember, a lot of these kids grew up post 9/11. We've been in war for like the majority of their lives. It is getting crazier and crazier and crazier. And so you have these kids that grew up where both parents worked full time because they had to survive. So they have very little like parental guidance. The kids are raising each other. I mean, if we're talking about like society as a whole is crumbling and nobody is waking up to it. And then we have these group of really sensitive individuals that become heroin addicts and drug addicts because they're just trying to cope with all the crazy shit that is going on. And then you try to put them in a model of care that's punitive and that's 12-step based, it is not going to work.
Are there any resources you'd like to mention? Or, I mean, I don't know, you know, like resources maybe in particular to listeners or people who aren't affluent or living in LA. Is there anything, any advice or anything you want to mention, I guess?
So our group, we have a group called Families United for Recovery. There are three separate meetings in the greater Los Angeles area. The biggest one is at our treatment center, Allo House, on Wednesday nights at 6:30. Many of these are live streamed. If you can find the Facebook page, Families United for Recovery on Facebook, we live stream these groups. They are extremely valuable and helpful and free. As far as people who can't afford insurance or people that are on Medicaid, it's really hard to get treatment, and that's really sad. And unfortunately, the current government is going to make it harder and harder for people to receive access to treatment. They're going to be able to receive access to Suboxone and methadone, but not to treatment to deal with the underlying issues that you need to get sober. It's really hard. And in Allo, we actually, because the insurance companies make it so difficult for us, we can't even accept the two plans that are offered in California. And our local hospital actually doesn't even accept Blue Cross, which is one of the only healthcare carriers in our area. So Evan is really working hard with Jared and Bob to open a place in Long Beach that would be an in-network or Medicaid facility. So we're really working hard to find a space that's big enough that we would be able to make that work. We're also talking about starting a nonprofit. There used to be places before the Affordable Care Act, like Cry Help, where if you didn't have insurance or you only had Medicaid, you could go. Now there is one place, Tarzana Treatment Center, that I know of, but there's a 6-week waiting list. There's just not enough access. It is a public healthcare crisis, and there's not enough access to be able to help these people, and it's really sad. And then the last thing that I would say is if you're really desperate, go to an AA or an NA meeting. Those people are there to help you. And if you're really, really ready, then that's always an option. But yeah, it's really sad, the lack of access that people have to getting help when they really need it.
Well, Alexis, I just want to say thank you so much. This was really thoughtful and I think really beneficial.
My pleasure. I'm so happy that you had me and we were able to have this really important discussion. I think that the work that you're doing is great and I'm glad that you're putting yourself out there to talk about it.
I am the real hero here. Thank you so much for listening to Dirtcast, and thank you to Alexis Haynes. Our show is produced by Levi Sharp and was mixed by Jamie Colazzo. Manana Mofidi is our executive director of audio. Our theme music is by Stuart Wood. A very special thank you to our intern, Rachel Withers, who finished her time with us and did a lot of work on this episode, as well as many others over the past month. So we owe her a huge thanks. If you are a podcaster and have a budget, we recommend her a million times over.
She's amazing.
If you want to send us a tip or just let us know what you think, hit us up at dirtcast@jezebel.com. You can find us on Spotify, NPR One, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.